This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Yosemite by John Muir. Chapter 1, Section E. An Unexpected Adventure. A wild scene, but not a safe one, is made by the moon as it appears through the edge of the Yosemite Fall when one is behind it. Once, after enjoying the night song of the waters and watching the formation of the colored bow as the moon came round the domes and sent her beams into the wild uproar, I ventured out on the narrow bench that extends back of the fall from Fern Ledge and began to admire the dim-veiled grandeur of the view. I could see the fine gauzy threads of the fall's filmy border by having the light in front, and wishing to look at the moon through the meshes of some of the denser portions of the fall, I ventured to creep farther behind it while it was gently wind-swayed, without taking sufficient thought about the consequences of its swaying back to its natural position after the wind pressure should be removed. The effect was enchanting, fine savage music sounding above, beneath, around me, while the moon, apparently in the very midst of the rushing waters, seemed to be struggling to keep her place on account of the ever-varying form and density of the water masses through which she was seen, now darkly veiled or eclipsed by a rush of thick-headed comets, now flashing out through the openings between their tails. I was in fairyland between the dark wall and the wild throng of illumined waters, but suffered sudden disenchantment, for, like the witch scene in Alloway Kirk, in an instant all was dark. Down came a dash of spent comets, thin and harmless-looking in the distance, but they felt desperately solid and stony when they struck my shoulders, like a mixture of choking spray and gravel and big hailstones. Instinctively dropping on my knees, I gripped an angle of the rock, curled up like a young fern frond with my face pressed against my breast, and in this attitude submitted as best I could to my thundering bath. The heavier masses seemed to strike like cobblestones, and there was a confused noise of many waters about my ears, hissing, gurgling, clashing sounds that were not heard as music. The situation was quickly realized. How fast one's thoughts burn in such times of stress! I was weighing chances of escape. Would the column be swayed a few inches away from the wall, or would it come yet closer? The fall was in flood, and not so lightly would its ponderous mass be swayed. My fate seemed to depend on a breath of the idle wind. It was moved gently forward, the pounding ceased, and I was once more visited by glimpses of the moon. But fearing I might be caught at a disadvantage in making too hasty a retreat, I moved only a few feet along the bench to where a block of ice lay. I wedged myself between the ice and the wall and lay face downwards until the steadiness of the light gave encouragement to rise and get away. Somewhat nerve-shaken, drenched, and benumbed, I made out to build a fire, warmed myself, ran home, reached my cabin before daylight, got an hour or two of sleep, and awoke sound and comfortable, better, not worse, for my hard midnight bath. Climate and weather. Owing to the westerly trend of the valley and its vast depth, there is a great difference between the climates of the north and south sides, greater than between many countries far apart. For the south wall is in shadow during the winter months, while the north is bathed in sunshine every clear day. Thus there is mild spring weather on one side of the valley while winter rules the other. Far up the north side cliffs, many a nook may be found closely embraced by sun-beaten rock bosses in which flowers bloom every month of the year. Even butterflies may be seen in these high winter gardens except when snowstorms are falling and a few days after they have ceased. Near the head of the lower Yosemite Fall in January, I found the antlions lying in wait in their warm sand cups, rock ferns being unrolled, club mosses covered with fresh-growing plants, the flowers of the laurel nearly open, and the honeysuckle rosetted with bright young leaves. Every plant seemed to be thinking about summer. Even on the shadow side of the valley, the frost is never very sharp. The lowest temperature I ever observed during four winters was 7 degrees Fahrenheit. The first 24 days of January had an average temperature at 9 a.m. of 32 degrees, minimum 22 degrees. At 3 p.m. the average was 40 degrees, the minimum 32. Along the top of the walls, 7,000 and 8,000 feet high, the temperature was, of course, much lower. But the difference in temperature between the north and south sides is due not so much to the winter sunshine as to the heat of the preceding summer, stored up in the rocks, which rapidly melts the snow in contact with them. For though summer sun heat is stored in the rocks of the south side also, the amount is much less because the rays fall obliquely on the south wall even in summer, and almost vertically on the north. The upper branches of the Yosemite streams are buried every winter beneath a heavy mantle of snow, and set free in the spring in magnificent floods. Then, all the fountains full and overflowing, every living thing breaks forth into singing, and the glad, exulting streams, shining and falling in the warm, sunny weather, shake everything into music, making all the mountain world a song. The great annual spring thaw usually begins in May in the forest region, and in June and July on the High Sierra, varying somewhat both in time and fullness with the weather and the depth of the snow. Toward the end of summer, the streams are at their lowest ebb, few even of the strongest singing much above a whisper as they slip and ripple through gravel and boulder beds from pool to pool in the hollows of their channels, and drop in pattering showers like rain, and slip down precipices and fall in sheets of embroidery, fold over fold. But, however low their singing, it is always ineffably fine in tone, in harmony with the restful time of the year. The first snow of the season that comes to help of the streams usually falls in September or October, sometimes even in the latter part of August, in the midst of yellow Indian summer when the goldenrods and gentians of the glacier meadows are in their prime. This Indian summer snow, however, soon melts, the chilled flowers spread their petals to the sun, and the gardens as well as the streams are refreshed as if only a warm shower had fallen. The snowstorms that load the mountains to form the main fountain supply for the year seldom set in before the middle or end of November. Winter Beauty of the Valley. When the first heavy storms stopped work on the high mountains, I made haste down to my Yosemite den, not to hole up and sleep the white months away. I was out every day, and often all night, sleeping but little, studying the so-called wonders and common things ever on show, wading, climbing, sauntering among the blessed storms and calms, rejoicing in almost everything alike that I could see or hear, the glorious brightness of frosty mornings, the sunbeams pouring over the white domes and crags into the groves and waterfalls, kindling marvelous iris fires in the hoarfrost and spray, the great forests and mountains in their deep noon sleep, the good night alpenglow, the stars, the solemn gazing moon, drawing the huge domes and headlands one by one glowing white out of the shadows, hushed and breathless like an audience in awful enthusiasm, while the meadows at their feet sparkle with frost stars like the sky, the sublime darkness of storm nights when all the lights are out, the clouds in whose depths the frail snow flowers grow, the behavior and many voices of the different kinds of storms, trees, birds, waterfalls, and snow avalanches in the ever-changing weather. Every clear, frosty morning, loud sounds are heard booming and reverberating from side to side of the valley at intervals of a few minutes, beginning soon after sunrise and continuing an hour or two like a thunderstorm. In my first winter in the valley, I could not make out the source of this noise. I thought of falling boulders, rock blasting, etc. Not till I saw what looked like hoarfrost dropping from the side of the fall was the problem explained. The strange thunder is made by the fall of sections of ice formed of spray that is frozen on the face of the cliff along the sides of the upper Yosemite Fall, a sort of crystal plaster, a foot or two thick, racked off by the sunbeams, awakening all the valley-like cock-crowing, announcing the finest weather, shouting aloud nature's infinite industry and love of hard work in creating beauty. Exploring an ice cone. This frozen spray gives rise to one of the most interesting winter features of the valley, a cone of ice at the foot of the fall, 400 or 500 feet high. From the fern ledge standpoint, its crater-like throat is seen, down which the fall plunges with deep, gasping explosions of compressed air, and, after being well churned in the wormy interior, the water bursts forth through arched openings at its base, apparently scourged and weary and glad to escape, while belching spray, spouted up out of the throat past the descending current, is wafted away in irised drifts to the adjacent rocks and groves. It is built during the night and early hours of the morning. Only in spells of exceptionally cold and cloudy weather is the work continued through the day. The greater part of the spray material falls in crystalline showers direct to its place, something like a small local snowstorm, but a considerable portion is first frozen on the face of the cliff along the sides of the fall and stays there until expanded and cracked off in irregular masses, some of them tons in weight, to be built into the walls of the cone, while in windy, frosty weather, when the fall is swayed from side to side, the cone is well drenched, and the loose ice masses and spray dust are all firmly welded and frozen together. Thus the finest of the downy wafts and curls of spray dust, which in mild nights fall about as silently as dew, are held back until sunrise to make a store of heavy ice to reinforce the waterfall's thunder tones. While the cone is in process of formation, growing higher and wider in the frosty weather, it looks like a beautiful, smooth, pure white hill, but when it is wasting and breaking up in the spring, its surface is strewn with leaves, pine branches, stones, sand, etc., that have been brought over the fall, making it look like a heap of avalanche detritus. Anxious to learn what I could about the structure of this curious hill, I often approached it in calm weather and tried to climb it, carrying an axe to cut steps. Once I nearly succeeded in gaining the summit. At the base I was met by a current of spray and wind that made seeing and breathing difficult. I pushed on backward, however, and soon gained the slope of the hill, whereby creeping close to the surface, most of the choking blast passed over me, and I managed to crawl up with but little difficulty. Thus I made my way nearly to the summit, halting at times to peer up through the wild whirls of spray at the veiled grandeur of the fall, or to listen to the thunder beneath me. The whole hill was sounding as if it were a huge bellowing drum. I hoped that by waiting until the fall was blown aslant, I should be able to climb to the lip of the crater and get a view of the interior, but a suffocating blast, half air, half water, followed by the fall of an enormous mass of frozen spray from a spot high up on the wall, quickly discouraged me. The whole cone was jarred by the blow, and some fragments of the mass sped past me dangerously near, so I beat a hasty retreat, chilled and drenched, and lay down on a sunny rock to dry. Once during a windstorm, when I saw that the fall was frequently blown westward, leaving the cone dry, I ran up to Fern Ledge, hoping to gain a clear view of the interior. I set out at noon. All the way up, the storm notes were so loud about me that the voice of the fall was almost drowned by them. Notwithstanding the rocks and bushes everywhere were drenched by the wind-driven spray, I approached the brink of the precipice, overlooking the mouth of the ice cone, but I was almost suffocated by the drenching, gusty spray, and was compelled to seek shelter. I searched for some hiding place in the wall from whence I might run out at some opportune moment, when the fall with its whirling spray and torn shreds of comet tails and trailing, tattered skirts was borne westward, as I had seen it carried several times before, leaving the cliffs on the east side and the ice hill bare in the sunlight. I had not long to wait, for, as if ordered so for my special accommodation, the mighty downrush of comets, with their whirling drapery, swung westward and remained aslant for nearly half an hour. The cone was admirably lighted and deserted by the water, which fell most of the time on the rocky western slopes, mostly outside of the cone. The mouth into which the fall pours was, as near as I could guess, about 100 feet in diameter north and south, and about 200 feet east and west, which is about the shape and size of the fall at its best, in its normal condition at this season. The crater-like opening was not a true oval, but more like a huge coarse mouth. I could see down the throat about 100 feet, or perhaps farther. The fall precipice overhangs from a height of 400 feet above the base. Therefore, the water strikes some distance from the base of the cliff, allowing space for the accumulation of a considerable mass of ice between the fall and the wall. End of section E and end of chapter 1.